Hello, I'm Sarah Crown, editor of Guardian.co.uk Books. As many of you may know, this week has been designated Agatha Christie Week. There are festivals, broadcasts and events going on around the country to celebrate the Queen of Crime's birthday. And I'm here in the studio with John Curran, the author of Agatha Christie's Secret Notebooks, which came out at the end of last month. Hi, John.
Hi, Sarah.
So can you tell me, first of all, what are these notebooks and in what sense were they secret?
Well, these are the notebooks that Agatha Christie used throughout her working life to write her plot ideas, her outlines for virtually all of her books, short stories, plays, her autobiography, her poetry, and also, interestingly, lists of flowers for the garden, lists of items to buy for Christmas presents, things to move from one house to another. So even though they're officially her working notebooks, they were also used as diaries and jotters.
So those are, they're personal as well as professional?
They are quite personal. Obviously, there's far less personal than professional. But it just makes you realise this was Agatha Christie the woman as well as Agatha Christie the Queen of Crime.
And can you tell me how they were discovered?
Well, in fairness, their existence has been known, and both her official biographer, Janet Morgan, in 1984, and Laura Thompson 2 years ago, mentioned them in their books. But this is the first time they've been analysed in any detail. So when I found them, it was in Greenway House, her holiday home in Devon, and it was at the top of the stairs was a long, narrow room full of papers, her typescripts, manuscripts, letters, contracts, theatre programmes, film posters, and a very undistinguished-looking brown cardboard box with 73 notebooks at the bottom of a cupboard.
So it must have felt like finding the Holy Grail.
Absolutely. It was like a child in a sweet shop. I stayed up way into the night the first day that I came across them. Matthew Pritchard, her grandson, had invited me to stay in Greenway. And we got there at tea time on a Friday and we left at lunchtime on a Sunday. And I spent 24 hours in the room at the top of the stairs looking through Agatha Christie's notebooks.
Now, I've heard her handwriting was quite difficult to read.
Her handwriting during her hugely prolific period, which would be roughly 1930 to 1955, was like shorthand in many cases. It was very, very difficult to read. But the more I read, the easier it became, because the first job when I was writing the book was to convert all of the notebooks into Word documents. And that took between six to eight months. And I found that if I had a particularly difficult page, if I left it and went back to it, one or two words would suddenly appear. And then if I left it another while, two or three more. So I suppose my eyesight just got used to reading it. But it was like shorthand in many cases.
So the parallels are very attractive, aren't they, between Agatha Christie, the woman, and you as the literary detective,
you know, piecing it all together.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, because when I had converted them all, it was like a big literary jigsaw, because some novels are scattered over 10 or maybe 12 notebooks, and it might only be an isolated sentence here or an isolated page there. So it was a matter of matching that all together to get what I think are all the notes that pertain to one particular title.
And can you quantify their value to Christie scholars?
Well, they're just
literally yourself.
They're literally priceless. And the amazing thing I think about them is when you look at them, they're totally unimpressive. I mean, there's a picture of them at the end papers of the book, and they're like the ordinary exercise books we all used at school. You have the wide spaced blue lines, and some of them have lost their covers, and she's jotted things on the front of them. And because during the year I was writing the book, and I would say to people, I'm writing a book about Agatha Christie's notebooks, people assume there was a notebook for Murder on the Orient Express and a notebook for the ABC murders, but nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm. And probably the most eye-grabbing thing about the book is the promise of two previously unpublished Poirot stories. Why weren't they published before?
Well, I speculate in the book, as to when they were written and B, why they were never published. I feel I've come up with fairly valid reasons why. I think one of them was politically sensitive, and the other one, she decided to turn it, instead of using it as a short story, that she turned it into a novel. But the interesting thing, I think, about that story is the fact that even though the basic situation is the same in both the short story and the novel,
Which novel is this?
It's the short story is The Incident of the Dog's Ball, and the novel is the 1937 Poirot novel Dumb Witness. So the basic situation is the same, but she comes up with a completely different killer and motive in each of them. So the existence of that story has been known for a while, but the fact that it was so similar to Dumb Witness militated against its publication. But I argued that the fact that she used the same situation and came up with a different solution was a point in its favour and of great interest to people who are Christie aficionados, because it showed how resourceful she was as a plot technician.
Yes, that's the most fascinating thing, really, isn't it? That you can have all of the elements of the story and take it in a completely different direction.
Absolutely. And in one of the other books that I discussed, Death Comes as the End, it was the one book that she took advice on writing, and she actually gave in to somebody as regards the ending. So in her notebooks, she has her original ending. In the published version, we have the official ending, if you like. And then further notes in the notebook show that she had a very, very unusual idea for the rest of the book, and it probably would have entailed a third ending. So no further proof could be needed as to how resourceful she was with her plot ideas.
And speaking personally, when you were reading the notebooks, what was the most exciting moment for you?
Well, when I realised what I was looking at, and I remember sitting in the room, or actually kneeling on the floor of the room, to be strictly accurate, going through them and saying, oh, here's the Evil Under the Sun, and then a few pages later, oh, here's the ABC murders. Personally, the Death Comes at the End, that's the book I mentioned a moment ago, where she agreed, well, she changed the ending on the advice of somebody else and regretted it for the rest of her professional life. So that was the one that I wanted to solve personally, and I think I did. And I made a beeline for the notes on that when I did find that notebook.
You're a lifelong fan of Agatha Christie. How did you first encounter her?
Well, like millions of people the world over, I began reading Agatha Christie at school. And then I worked my way through Christie, and then I worked my way through most of her contemporaries. So I read virtually the entire genre of crime fiction, almost exclusively. But I keep coming back to Agatha Christie because, as far as I'm concerned, she was the best. And as proof of that, of her contemporaries, with the possible exception of Dorothy Sayers, she's still a household name, whereas most of her contemporaries have faded into history, apart from people who are devoted fans. And Christie has crossed every barrier of race and culture and age, and there seems to be no stopping.
What is it about her that gives her this longevity? I mean, we've talked about her technical prowess. Do you think that's
part of the story? I devote a chapter in the book to speculating about that, and certainly her prowess with plot has to be a factor. But I think her readability, because she can be read by your grandchildren or by your grandparents. She can be read regardless of your standard of education. I mean, people in school read them, nuclear physicists read them. The Archbishop of Canterbury was an Agatha Christie fan. So she seems to cross every barrier of education and race and culture and religion and creed. I suppose the glib answer is, if I knew what it was, I'd be at home doing it. But I think readability and plot, as you say, plot prowess, have to be two major factors.
Do you think, we talked earlier about Agatha Christie the woman, do you think we have a tendency to treat her like one of her novels as a problem that can be solved, you know?
Well, I'm never convinced, not just talking about Agatha Christie, that if someone writes a biography, you can really get to know the person. I don't really think that is possible. And there's always this story that, you know, Agatha Christie was an enigma, which I think is because she was a mystery writer. If she was Agatha Christie, the concert pianist, people wouldn't say the same thing about her, I feel. As a woman, she was very, very shy. I mean, she wouldn't have done this sort of thing. She didn't give interviews. She refused completely to appear on TV, because I've seen letters to and from her agent from the BBC asking, would she agree under any circumstances to be interviewed? And the answer was always no. There is a recording of her speaking on a BBC radio interview, but it's quite obvious that she's reading from a script. And actually, I found the script in amongst her papers. So even that wasn't spontaneous. So her shyness was almost paranoid, which adds to her mystique. But she did have a valid point when she said, well, I mean, I write, that's what I do. There's no reason to expect me to be a good raconteur or a good conversationalist. She wrote so much, she hardly had time to give interviews. But that has all added to the mystique of, you know, the woman behind the mysteries. But there are aspects of the woman in the notebooks, like a list of dahlias that she wants the gardener to get, or a list of Christmas presents, or, you know, jotting down travel train times in the middle of peril at End House. And talking to her grandson, she had a very, very happy family life, and she was a good conversationalist within her own circle. But she wouldn't have done, you know, Q&As in the British Library.
Given her desire for privacy and her shyness, did you at any point have any qualms about publishing these books of hers that have been private notebooks?
Yes, I must say I did, because I think there's very little doubt that if she was still around, she would never have given permission for them to be looked at in the first place. But what I wanted to do with the book was underline the genius of Agatha Christie for people out there who think, oh, well, anybody could do it. To which the answer is, well, if it is, go home and try it and see how difficult it actually is. So I wanted to underline the fact that this woman in her own sphere was a genius, the same way that George Best was a genius with a football. But the word genius is bandied around quite a lot nowadays. But within the sphere of the classical detective story, Agatha Christie was the genius. So I wanted to bring that to the fore. And also I wanted to write a book that would show facets of her that had never been seen before, because there are at least 50 books about almost every aspect of Agatha Christie, but a lot of them regurgitate the same information in different formats. But this has information about Agatha Christie, the plot technician and the greatest writer of classical detective fiction that ever did write and that ever will write, because by and large the type of book that she writes is no longer being written.
It's hard to imagine someone who hasn't encountered Agatha Christie in some form or another, either on the television
Absolutely.
Or on stage or in one of her books. But that's sort of, suppose for a moment that such person exists. What would be the book that you'd recommend?
Well, the one that I always recommend people to read first is And Then There Were None. I think it's probably her greatest technical achievement, even though it's not my favourite, but I do think it's her greatest technical achievement. And she did say that herself in her autobiography. And I do
it's
talk
perfect
about...
perfect mystery, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And it's a wonderful plot device. And signs on it, there's a new American TV programme about a group of people invited to an island for a wedding or a wedding anniversary, and they're all being killed one by one. So the plot has been imitated by so many people under so many different circumstances that it's one of the classic plots of all time. So it's a wonderful technical achievement. But my favourite of her books is Five Little Pigs, 1943 Poirot novel set in Greenway. She used the geography of the gardens of Greenway. And I think it's her closest to a straight novel, as well as being a formally classical detective story with all the clues. It is a wonderfully well-written novel with five very, very closely portrayed five little pigs, the five suspects in the murder case. So that is my favourite, and I think it's the peak of her career. But the one I always recommend is And Then There Were None.
Okay, John, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Sarah.
Happy birthday, Agatha.